Today is Monday, September 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the United States accuses Iran of being behind an attack on a Saudi Arabian oil field.
The United States wholeheartedly condemns Iran's attack on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Also ahead, more Brexit talks have taken place, but are they going anywhere? And the latest from Hong Kong as protests continue. These stories and more are next. U.S. President Donald Trump said the United States is locked and loaded after an attack on Saudi oil and has reason to believe that they know who the culprit is. Meanwhile, analysts are warning that if the price of oil continues to rise, it could further risk a global recession. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy starts us off.
Locked and loaded. That's the message from President Donald Trump, who said the U.S. was primed after weekend attacks on the world's largest oil processing facility in Saudi Arabia. Trump tweeted on Sunday saying there's reason to believe that we know the culprit. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also took to Twitter, blaming Iran for the attack on state oil giant Aramco instead of Yemen's Houthi rebels, who have claimed responsibility. So far, Iran has denied involvement in the strikes, which have wiped out 5% of global oil production, but have warned they're ready for a full-fledged war. It's inflaming investor concerns about the state of U.S.-Iran relations and stability in the Middle East. Satellite images released on Sunday showed huge plumes of thick black smoke over the Saudi facility. The attacks pushed oil prices to four-month highs on Monday amid concerns over global supply. Brent crude posted its highest percentage gain in a single day of trading in nearly three decades. Aramco has not given a timeline for when they'll fully recover from the attack, and analysts are warning over the effects that could have in the coming weeks and months. An oil price hike could impact the entire economic chain of big importers like China. One analyst told Reuters a disruption in oil supply could bring dire consequences to the global economy and increase the chances of a worldwide recession.
That was Michelle Hennessy from Reuters News. U.S. Secretary of Energy Rick Perry told the IAEA General Conference that the attack is of global significance.
Make no mistake about it. This was a deliberate attack on the global economy and the global energy market.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling in Europe with General Joe Dunford, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Chairman Joe Dunford has not come out and spoken to us about it, but I do know that he was part of the discussions that went on at the White House. He called in while the president was meeting with Defense Secretary Mark Esper, the Vice President, and Secretary of State Pompeo. So he is clued in on what's going on, and I can only imagine he was updating the President with all the options on the table, as well as looking into the intelligence we have. My sources at the Pentagon that I've been speaking with and outside of the Pentagon have not quite put it on Iran yet. We know that the Saudi military has said that Iranian weapons were used, but the United States, other than Secretary of State Pompeo, the Pentagon side of that haven't come out and said it was Iran. They're actually quite tight-lipped about this at the moment. I know they are investigating. I can only imagine that there are American troops on the ground right now. We do have troops in Saudi Arabia. And what I do know is that there were a bunch of targets. This was not just one singular attack. I've been told by a U.S. official that there were more than 10 different attacks on this oil field. And I've also been told by one official who would only speak to me on condition of strict anonymity, but he said that it did not look like this attack came from Iraq. So the Iraqi government had said that earlier. It looks like at least one U.S. official is confirming that it didn't come out of Iraq, but he would not confirm whether or not it came from Yemen or perhaps Iran.
We're talking about the attack on the Saudi oil field, but the other kind of flashpoint in the Persian Gulf has been the Strait of Hormuz. Have any of your contacts spoken about concern about escalated tensions in that region?
There is concern. And in fact, I am here in the United Kingdom. I was just speaking with diplomatic officials here, and they said that that is a huge concern for England. That is a huge concern for the United States. There has been a coalition that has been sort of monitoring the strait and trying to keep it secure. But we've seen attacks in the past. In May and June, there have been the other oil fields hit in Saudi Arabia. There have been tankers that have been targeted. So it is very, very interesting how this is going to play out. Iran continues to deny being a part of any of these attacks, and yet it seems to, at least in the attacks before this one, the United States and others have pinned the attacks on them. So tensions are definitely escalating, and I think that all sides are going to be trying to figure out what to do, because at what point does an official continue to let Iran meddle? And at what point does Saudi Arabia say enough is enough? And then where does that put the United States military and other allies? It's a very confusing situation right now.
Carlo Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent, currently traveling with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in London. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had his first meeting with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker today in hopes of securing a Brexit deal. Johnson says Britain will leave the EU on schedule October 31st with or without a withdrawal agreement. Now, joining us live on the phone from London is reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So what can you tell us about the outcome of today's talks?
Well, there appears to be little really of substance that have come out of today's talks. The British side, for their part, spoke of their hope that the EU has spoken of its willingness to engage on the questions Britain still has over Brexit, over its problems with the withdrawal agreement. But I think the positives for Britain end there, because the optics for today's visit to Luxembourg by Prime Minister Johnson were really not good at all. The meetings began in a restaurant in Luxembourg with, as you say, Jean-Claude Juncker and also the Luxembourg Prime Minister, Xavier Bettel. And outside that venue, there had gathered a group of anti-Brexit protesters. And they were very vocal. They had loud hailers. And as the podiums were being set up outside for a planned press conference between the Luxembourg Prime Minister and his British counterpart, they started to get louder, and the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, did not appear. However, his Luxembourg counterpart did. One podium was left empty, and so it was a one-man press conference, and the Luxembourg Prime Minister proceeded to describe Britain's approach as not coming up with anything new on the withdrawal agreement. He voiced anger at Britain trying to blame the EU for its problems. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson was nowhere to be seen. He then did some interviews with British media on television where he spoke of some progress being made, his confidence still of being able to get a deal, and his insistence on Britain still leaving with or without a deal on the 31st of October. But on the television screens now, what everyone is seeing is an absent prime minister, and by most measures, that's not a good look.
If we take a look at what's taking place in Britain, you know, you mentioned that Boris Johnson wasn't seen today publicly at the press conference, and that he's still very adamant about leaving on the 31st. There are some cases moving through the court system in Britain. One I can really think of right now is whether or not it was legal for him to prorogue Parliament.
That's right. That court case gets underway at the highest court of the land, the Supreme Court, tomorrow, Tuesday. And 11 judges there, the number increased from 9, indicating the significance of the case. They will have to decide whether Boris Johnson acted unlawfully in advising the Queen to give the go-ahead for the suspension of Parliament. And this rests on the justification for doing so. Boris Johnson says it needed to be done because he's a new prime minister. He wanted to launch a new manifesto, a new policy platform, and it's tradition to suspend Parliament, to have a new Queen's speech, and to start afresh. His critics say that's nonsense. The only reason he did it was to try to prevent MPs from scrutinizing and from potentially blocking his plans to leave the European Union on October the 31st. A court in London last week agreed with Boris Johnson and said it was legal. A court in Scotland said it was illegal. And so the judges, the first thing they're going to have to do is to reconcile these different laws, because there are different laws in Scotland and England, and come up with a decision. They've allotted 3 days to hear the case. It's not known whether they will come up with a judgment later this week or whether judgment will be reserved for a later date. But it has to be coming soon because, as you say, that deadline is approaching very fast.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The Solomon Islands switched diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China Monday, becoming the latest country to do so. The possibility of a switch had been widely reported in recent weeks. China and Taiwan split in 1949 during a civil war. Most countries recognize Beijing as the government of China, and China has been wooing the remaining ones to abandon the island territory. Fewer than 20 governments still recognize Taiwan. A special UN fact-finding mission has urged that Myanmar be held responsible in international legal forums for alleged genocide against its Muslim Rohingya minority. The Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar says in a report, wrapping up 2 years of documentation of human rights violations by security forces, that counterinsurgency operations in 2017 included genocidal acts. Civil society groups say they expect hundreds of thousands of people to join a worldwide protest for Climate Action Friday. Environmental activists, trade unions, and church groups in Germany said Monday that more than 400 rallies are planned in the country alone. Moody's announced it has downgraded Hong Kong's rating outlook to negative, saying that it reflects the rising risk that the ongoing protests reveal an erosion in the strength of Hong Kong's institutions. In addition, medical workers protested at a local hospital in Hong Kong to show their support for pro-democracy movement. VOA's Jeff Custer has that story as the special administrative region continues to endure nearly 4 months of protests.
Staff held up signs and chanted slogans as they stood in the foyer of Prince Wales Hospital before moving to different floors of the building. Nurse Cheng, who didn't want her first name used, said she had hopes Hong Kong would be peaceful and that the police will stop what she termed indiscriminate arrests and using excessive force. Anti-government protests have taken place in Hong Kong since June and have increasingly been marked by violence and clashes with police. Speaking at the United Nations Human Rights Council Monday, Hong Kong legislator Tanya Chan criticized the lack of accountability by the Hong Kong leadership over police actions.
The police call protesters cockroaches. Brutal crackdowns and preemptive violence against them are hence regarded as acceptable pest control to curb free speech. Today marks the 100th day of the movement, but there is no sign the police will exercise restraint. This is a result of the lack of democracy in Hong Kong, as the government is not held accountable for its endorsement of police abuse.
She urged the council to form a commission of inquiry to ensure that human rights of Hong Kong citizens were upheld. Dozens of university students also rallied peacefully on Monday, urging authorities to listen to public demands. Dressed in black, some of them donning face masks, students sang Glory to Hong Kong, a song that has become a rallying cry for more democratic freedoms in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Sunday, hundreds of Hong Kong protesters sang God Save the Queen and waved Union Jack flags outside the British consulate, demanding that the former colonial power ensures China honors its commitments to the city's freedoms. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said protesters who rallied in front of the British Consulate General in Hong Kong were despicable. On Sunday, which began as a mostly peaceful protest earlier in the day, spiraled into violence in some of the city's busiest shopping and tourist districts. Thousands of anti-government protesters, many clad in black masks, caps, and sunglasses to obscure their identities, raced through the streets, setting street fires and blocking roads in the heart of Hong Kong. Protesters are furious over what they see as creeping interference by Beijing in Hong Kong's affairs, despite promises by Beijing to grant the city wide-ranging autonomy and freedoms denied in mainland China. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
A South Korean newspaper reported Monday that Kim Jong-un invited U.S. President Donald Trump to Pyongyang in August amid stalled denuclearization talks. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
The next time Donald Trump meets with Kim Jong-un, it could be here. North Korea's capital, Pyongyang. That is, at least if the US president responds favorably to a letter from the North Korean leader he reportedly received in August, amid stalled denuclearization talks. A South Korean newspaper said on Monday, citing diplomatic sources, that Kim sent a letter to Trump in the third week of August, speaking of his willingness for a third summit and extending an invitation to the capital. On August the 9th, Trump said he received a, quote, very beautiful letter from Kim. But U.S. officials have not said anything about this second letter that month.
Speed is not that important to me.
The pair have met three times since June last year to discuss a crisis over North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. But progress has been scant. Their first two meetings were formal summits, the second of which, in Vietnam in February, broke down after they failed to narrow the gap between U.S. demands for denuclearization and North Korea's insistence on sanctions relief. They met for a third time in June in the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas, where they agreed to restart working-level talks. But that has not happened. Since the June meeting, North Korea has tested short-range projectiles on several occasions. The White House, the U.S. State Department, and the North Korean mission to the United Nations did not immediately respond to a request for comment. On Thursday, Trump said he would be willing to meet Kim at some point this year.
And that was David Doyle from Reuters News. And this is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the California Institute of Technology have discovered a near-Earth orbiting asteroid with the shortest year known for any asteroid in the solar system. Called 2019 LF6, this nearly 1 kilometer-wide rocky asteroid circles the Sun in an elliptical orbit over a 151-day period. The asteroid's orbit takes it from beyond Venus to closer to the Sun than Mercury. 2019 LF6 is known as an Altera asteroid, which are about 20 asteroids whose orbits are contained within Earth's orbit of the Sun. Though the 2019 LF6 is considered a near-Earth object, astronomers have determined that it is not considered potentially hazardous. The Caltech astronomers made their discovery with the Zwicky Transient Facility, a camera that was recently installed on a telescope at the Palomar Observatory near San Diego, California. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A panel of UN experts warns the failure of South Sudan's warring factions to implement last year's peace accord risks plunging the country into full-scale war once again. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the three-member Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan has presented its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council.
The Commission's report says nothing has changed for the better since South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar signed a peace accord aimed at ending the country's six-year civil war. The chair of the Commission, Yasmin Suka, reports more than 6 million people are going hungry. 1.3 million children under 5 are acutely malnourished, and millions more are stunted, affecting their physical growth, health, and mental development.
The starvation in South Sudan is neither random nor accidental. It has been part of a deliberate strategy on the part of the warring parties to target civilians in acts that may amount to war crimes. There is no doubt that the responsibility for the enduring humanitarian catastrophe in South Sudan rests firmly with the country's warring politicians.
Suka warns the clock on peace is running out. She says important provisions of the accord are not being implemented. She says this includes the disengagement of rival forces in preparation for the creation of a unified military force for South Sudan. She urges IGAD, the African Union, and the international community to deal effectively with armed groups to prevent a return to full-scale war. She says gross human rights violations are rampant and widespread, and levels of sexual and gender-based violence is exceedingly high, and providing justice for the victims has proven to be impossible.
In the military courts that are actually trying to prosecute perpetrators, The judges don't even have ink and paper to print their judgments and have been going to the market to print court documents, paying for it out of their own pockets. This is a government that can't supply stationery or even food, but has no problem buying bullets.
Not all assessments of South Sudan's near future are so bleak. In late August, IGAD representatives in Addis Ababa said last year's ceasefire had continued to hold and said the general security situation in South Sudan has improved. South Sudan's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Koola Law, says his government has been exerting efforts to restore stability and tranquility to the country in order to achieve peace. He says a fuller response to the commission's report will be made to the council by the Minister of Justice when he arrives in Geneva later in the week. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The first Chinese-born woman to sit in the lower house of Australia's federal parliament is under sustained attack for failing to disclose her membership in organizations linked to China's Communist Party. Phil Mercer has that story.
There are claims Gladys Liu had connections with senior figures in Beijing's covert political propaganda apparatus, which have raised questions about her eligibility to sit in the Australian parliament. The lawmaker has admitted being a member of the China Overseas Exchange Association between 2003 and 2015, which at the time was part of China's powerful State Council, the Chinese government's central political and administrative body. The Hong Kong-born politician says her membership was entirely innocent and has denied any conflict of interest. She said she's a proud Australian. Australia's centre-right Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Liu is the victim of a smear campaign with a grubby undertone. The political assault is led by the opposition Labour Party. It's demanded to know if the government had received warnings about her from Australia's intelligence agencies. Ministers have declined to comment. Labour Party leader Anthony Albanese denies the scrutiny of Liu is based on race and says he wants to get to the truth.
What the motivation is here is to ensure that there is accountability for people's actions. It has nothing to do with race, and the only person who has raised race in these issues are, of course, Prime Minister Morrison.
Gladys Liu is a former speech pathologist who became an Australian citizen in 1992. Her parliamentary career has collided with growing anxiety in Australia over allegations of Chinese meddling in its domestic politics and cyber espionage. A task force is to investigate foreign interference in Australia's universities because of fears over China's growing influence on campuses. These are sensitive issues, given Australia's reliance on China for its recent prosperity. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Purdue Pharma, their maker of prescription painkiller OxyContin, has filed for bankruptcy protection in a U.S. court. The AP's Julie Walker has the details.
The company that made billions selling the prescription painkiller OxyContin has filed for bankruptcy as it tries to settle lawsuits over its role in the opioid crisis. The bankruptcy filing comes after Purdue Pharma reached a tentative settlement, which could be worth up to $12 billion over time, with many of the more than 2,000 local and state governments across the country that are suing the company over its role in the opioid crisis. But the holdouts include more than half the states, and some of them are expected to object to the settlement in bankruptcy court and continue their lawsuits against the Sackler family, which owns the company. I'm Julie Walker.
Rick Ocasek, the lead singer and songwriter for the new wave rock band The Cars, has died at the age of 75. The Cars were founded in the late 1970s and went on to enjoy a number of chart-topping hits over the next decade, including Just What I Needed, Shake It Up, and this song, Drive. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Thank you so much for joining us. You'll find more stories on our website. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.